The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
Welcome to the Tuesday edition of Balance of Power. I'm Joe Matthew, live in Washington, where it's all about CPI day today. Everyone up early, including Molly Smith, to put pen to paper, or I guess type away, on the numbers here. We're going to dive into this with Molly in a second with the headline, not what the administration wants to see. Remember the hotter-than-expected jobs report on Friday? Well, now U.S. core inflation is topping forecasts again, and this has, of course, implications for the Federal Reserve, not to mention the outcome of this presidential election. Top line and core inflation up 0.4 from January. Molly Smith set the alarm extra early today as Bloomberg economics editor to crank this out at 8:30. That's got to be a little bit of heartburn, right? I mean, when the big ones hit like this, the jobs day, the CPI day, everybody's watching.
It certainly wakes you up at that hour for sure, Joe. And I got to say, like, just hearing Charlie run through the market trading right now, I'm just baffled at like why stocks are up as much as they are. I would love to hear what good news investors saw in this, because I really didn't see it from my seat.
Okay, so let's get into it, because, you know, on Friday we were talking about the push-pull of the jobs report, and, you know, you can find a good story to tell if you look at it the right way. In this case, shelter's up, gasoline is up, cars up, clothing, airfares. Have you tried to book a flight lately? This is what people are talking about at home.
Yeah, exactly. So like you just said, this was just a lot of, you know, pretty robust reading across the board. I mean, I guess if you really wanted to slice and dice it, the positive here, so to speak, was that there was a bit of a pullback in this really narrow category of services inflation that the Fed looks at very closely. If you've heard people describe core services ex housing. So this is what this one pulled back a bit from, like, a very strong January reading, but really went more from like rising very sharply to still rising pretty quickly. So I wouldn't say it was exactly a slam dunk in terms of people looking for positive news to take away. Maybe that shelter inflation also did come down a bit, but shelter combined with gasoline contributed to over 60% of the rise in the overall CPI in the month. So these are things that people pay for every day. So if you're the average American consumer right now, it certainly doesn't make you feel good to know that your housing costs and gasoline are still very much rising.
Yeah, right. Is there hope, at least in the volatility behind energy prices? I mean, obviously, gasoline has seasonal factors here. Maybe you see some relief in the next couple of months, or is that wishful thinking?
It's certainly possible. I mean, this was the first rise in the whole energy category that we saw in 5 months. So, you know, lately that had been a driver more of disinflation on the overall headline. But as you said, these things are seasonal. You know, patterns can change. And also when you see airfares so high, more people might want to drive. And then that could drive up the, you know, demand for gasoline and therefore the price of that as well.
No. And the cycle continues. What can you tell us about airfares? The biggest monthly advance, did I read that right?
Yes, the biggest monthly advance since May of 22. So that one really came up quite a bit in the month. And it's interesting because we saw a report earlier today from Southwest saying that they're going to have to reduce capacity given all of the struggles that they're having with fewer Boeing deliveries, as you know, we certainly know about that story and how that's been playing out. But I think that's something you I think Ryanair may have also warned of something similar to capacity constraints. So that's, of course, also just going to push up prices more so. So I'm not sure if that was a factor in the February reading, but certainly could be in the months ahead.
Have you flown since the door blowout, Molly?
I flew in last month. I did fly, so maybe I'm contributing to the problem. But I booked the flights well in advance, and they were. It was like a $200 round trip fare to Atlanta, so I think that's pretty good.
Pretty good. Might be twice that by now. Did you try to sit, you know, see people getting on the plane, they're trying to figure out where the door plug is, even if there isn't one on the plane.
Oh, my goodness.
And then they buckle up before being told. That's a fascinating element of this for me. I don't know about you.
Yeah, I mean, look, I would do it, too, if I was nervous that a part of the plane was going to blow out when I was, you know, 30,000 feet in the air. So any precaution necessary.
All right, so we've got PPI tomorrow. Does this take on new meaning? Because I have to ask you about the Fed here, of course. Molly Smith, everybody says that this means we're not going to see anything till June at the earliest.
Yeah, it looks like that's where most of the bets are circling around. So we're getting PPI on Thursday, I believe, and that one's going to be like the last major inflation report that we get before the Fed's meeting next week. Obviously, I don't think really anyone right now is expecting a rate cut at that meeting. So that's very much penciled in to be a fifth straight hold on interest rates. So the PPI is important. This is prices paid to U.S. producers. So it's a measure of wholesale inflation. And this is really more important when you're talking to economic forecasters, because there are categories within the PPI that filter into what's known as the PCE, and that's the Fed's preferred inflation measure. There were some of those parts in the inflation report today as well. So a lot of economists say once the PPI numbers come out, that's when they start to firm up their estimates for PCE, which, by the way, is running much lower than the CPI does, in part because it doesn't weight shelter as heavily. So that one is trending a lot closer to the Fed's 2% target. And that's really more the one that drives policy, in their opinion.
Fascinating. She's the smartest person in the room, which is why we try to talk around times like this when the data are so important. Molly Smith, it's great to see you, Molly. Thank you. We'll connect on the next major data point, I am sure. Bloomberg Economics Editor, we bring you to the source. I hope you get to sleep at some point. Molly, you know, it's primary day. Because every time we talk about this economic stuff, we have to do it against the backdrop of politics. And if you're Joe Biden, this is topic number one, right? Unless, of course, I'm told that the poll says the border is more important than the economy. But we're coming pretty close here. Certainly as we head around the rest of the country with primary elections. And today we've got some big ones, none bigger or more influential or potentially more revealing than the one in Georgia. As I read in the AJC, the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, the Georgia primary could set a presidential rematch, but there is more to it than that. As we try to read tea leaves here, results could give both of these men, Joe Biden and Donald Trump, insight into the depths of their voter support. And that's where we start our conversation with Andra Gillespie. Back with us to talk about Georgia politics, and by that, I guess I mean national politics, because it's pretty hard to separate the two. Associate Professor of Political Science at Emory University. Andra, it's great to see you. What will we learn tonight from Georgia that we can apply to the rest of the nation?
Well, today is a day for both the Democratic and the Republican parties to practice their get-out-the-vote efforts and their mobilization strategies. We know already who's going to win these primaries, and we know that at some point tonight, whether it's in Georgia or Mississippi, Donald Trump is going to cross the delegate threshold to be able to secure the Republican nomination. That's likely to happen for President Biden sometime next week, perhaps Florida or Ohio. Mm-hmm. But since we know that they have either no competition anymore or nominal competition at best on the Democratic side. I think what we're going to be paying attention to is who bothers to show up. It's important in Georgia to keep in mind that people have been voting for weeks already in early voting. But if we see robust turnout on both sides, I think that that is a harbinger of how competitive the race is going to be in Georgia. And this election is really going to come down to which campaign gets their people out to vote. This isn't about persuasion. It is about mobilization.
You mentioned the early vote. I wonder to what extent that might influence the outcome with folks voting when Nikki Haley was still in the race. Could that bring some noise to these numbers, not to Donald Trump's benefit?
Well, so Georgia has a hybrid system where delegates are allocated. The winner gets a certain number of delegates, and then delegates are also allocated via congressional district. You know, it is possible that Haley could win a district. But as we saw in Super Tuesday last week, even in places where you would expect Republicans to be more moderate, Donald Trump actually did really well in those types of counties. So I think it really does become a question of whether or not Nikki Haley could still win some delegates in, say, the 5th congressional district, you know, or maybe one of the more Democratic-leaning districts. Who's to say? Either way, between Georgia or Mississippi, and it's probably more likely to be Mississippi, Donald Trump is going to have enough delegates to be the presumptive Republican nominee.
Well, that's interesting. You mentioned turnout, and I wonder what the level of interest is in Georgia. When you go to ground, what are people talking about? How are the ads playing, et cetera?
So, you know, it's still pretty early. The Biden campaign in particular has just done an ad buy. And so we're going to see what the fruits of that look like in the coming weeks. I think it's just really important and symbolic to note that both Donald Trump and Joe Biden were in Georgia on Saturday. And so I look at that as an unofficial kickoff of the 2024 general election cycle. The fact that they were here having competing rallies before a primary election, but during a week where it became very, very clear that these were likely going to be the presumptive nominees, I think is symbolically really important. Georgia is a state that Democrats cannot lose if they want to continue to hold the White House. And it is a state that Republicans wouldn't want to lose because it's a psychological blow. So it's going to be important until the polls show that one of these candidates has a definitive and consistent lead.
We're spending time with Andre Gillespie of Emory University here on Balance of Power. Andre, you were with us back in December of 22 when we came to Atlanta for the special Senate election. Of course, Raphael Warnock beat Herschel Walker, and there was a conversation in the air as we spoke to officials like Secretary Raffensperger, even the way your governor was talking at the time, of a conservative Republican not in the MAGA camp. And there was a question about exactly what a Georgia Republican might look like. This is a different world, it seems like we're in now, isn't it?
Well, I mean, it is a slightly different circumstance. So Brian Kemp and Brad Raffensperger are not MAGA Republicans, but they're Republicans and loyal ones at that. You know, it is highly unlikely that they're going to endorse Joe Biden or vote for Joe Biden or even abstain from voting in the presidential election because of the tension that they have had with the Trump campaign. So they, you know, may not be walking arm in arm and campaigning in lockstep with Donald Trump, but it's highly unusual to expect for them to, you know, not ultimately be supportive of former President Trump as the Republican nominee.
Sure. And I do hear you. But my God, if you went back to that day when we spoke about the Senate race, could you have imagined projecting a year out that Donald Trump would be the commanding favorite in the Republican primary in Georgia?
It's not surprising. Primary elections tend to turn out your most politically active and your most ideologically extreme voters. And so there is a tendency in primary elections for the extremes to actually really be the cast the deciding vote in terms of who the nominee is going to be. And so in this case, Donald Trump still enjoys high levels of support among the base. And so the base is turning out in strong numbers to ratify their choice for a candidate. It doesn't negate Brian Kemp's operation in the state, his history with voters in the state, or his incumbency advantage in 2022. And so you can do both at the same time. And so Republicans can still support somebody who they've known for years, who has a strong operation in the state, while at the same time supporting this new wave of a Republican candidate like Donald Trump and his allies.
Well, so, Andre, could Joe Biden win Georgia again today? Would he be able to pull this off again? And what will you be looking for tonight to help answer that question?
So, I mean, it is a bit of an apples to kind of pears or oranges comparison. But, you know, if there is very lackluster turnout in the Democratic primary, that probably isn't a good warning sign. And so the Biden campaign would have to make sure that they are redoubling their efforts to set up field offices across the state and sending people out to do the hard work of talking to voters on their doorsteps and on their phones to make sure that they actually do turn out to vote in an election. There's still a numerical disadvantage for Democrats in the state. What Democrats have been able to demonstrate in the last few election cycles, though, is that if they're running against a very problematic Republican candidate, they may be able to make the case to get more Democrats to turn out to vote. But Democrats are going to have to find every possible Democratic voter and make sure that they actually show up to vote in November. Otherwise, they probably will lose the race.
Have you heard talk of irregularities, security concerns, anything that the secretary has been trying to avoid?
No, I haven't heard anything. I don't expect that there are going to be those types of allegations made tonight. You know, it could be in part because Donald Trump is expected to coast to victory in the state. But it's, you know, it's important for us to keep in mind that Brad Raffensperger brings an engineer's eye to running elections. And so he has done everything humanly possible to make sure that there are no errors in the contest and that the vote is counted accurately and fairly. And I think voters should have confidence in that.
Well, I'm glad you could come talk to us today. I don't know, with the apples to pears comparison, maybe I get a B in the class, but I'm trying. Andre Gillespie, it's great to see you. Happy primary day in Georgia. Come back and see us again.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle-market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
We are broadcasting to you live from Washington, where, of course, inflation data is not just something that markets pay attention to. It's something the White House pays attention to as well, Joe. President Biden having to put out a statement in reaction to this slightly hot CPI we got today, saying, as he said in the State of the Union, we have more to do to lower costs and give the middle class a fair shot.
That's right. And by that, I mean another 4 years to finish the job. And that has been the refrain from the White House. Maybe we hear more of that. If we start to see a reacceleration here, I guess it's more of a plateau, but it makes us realize that this does not, or it reminds us that this does not move in a straight line. And we wanted to talk to Anna Wong about that, who joins us from here in Washington. Bloomberg Economics Chief U.S. Economist. We're going all the way to the top here, Anna. Thank you for joining us. How would you characterize this? Is it a plateau at 4/10, or is there something else going on here?
I think it is a sigh of relief, and that's the reason why the market was rallying in response on the day of today's CPI release, as opposed to January, even though the core CPI in January and February are the same at 0.4%. And the reason why is because everyone today was watching how the owner's equivalent rent inflation is doing. In January, that OER category jumped. And it's supposed to be a stickier form of inflation. So everybody was worried. But in today's report, we saw that it came back on track for disinflation in the rest of the year. So that was what caused a sigh of relief. And Powell also thinks that rents, housing rents will be coming down, will be the key driver of disinflation this year. So I guess for everybody who's driving the market rally today, it is due to that relief that one powerful force of disinflation is still on track.
And yet, Anna, we're still not at 2%. You mentioned Fed Chair Jerome Powell. How is the Fed likely to look at today's data? Does it provide them any real evidence that they need to cut rates anytime soon, that they should?
Yeah, so you know, also another factor contributing to the high reading today and January is this thing called residual seasonality. Generally, businesses like to mark up prices in January and February. So I think Powell already knows this because we heard from him in his testimony last week that he said he didn't need to see better inflation print. In fact, he even said it could be a little bit worse because I think he expected that the seasonal factors will lead to higher January and February reading. And according to our projection, so even if inflation continue at this path, and we are still likely going to see 12-month change in core PCE getting down to 2.5% or below by middle of the year.
Gasoline and shelter contributing to over 60% here, Anna, of the overall monthly advance. One of those, in terms of energy, gas prices, could be quite volatile. We could actually see some movement there. Is it possible that that's the key to a lower reading next month?
Well, yeah, you're right, Joe. Gasoline is very volatile. We just had 2 months of negative reading. So it could be that next month could be up or down. But most importantly, the Fed is going to look through gasoline. And the Fed will be focusing on inflation expectations 1 year ahead. And from New York Fed's data yesterday, we saw that inflation expectations is actually coming down. So that's what matters for the Fed.
All right, Anna Wong, Chief U.S. Economist for us at Bloomberg Economics. Thank you so much, as always, for joining us, especially on CPI Day. But of course, it isn't just CPI Day here in Washington. It is also Robert Herr Testimony Day. As Joe and I were talking about, today is the day in which he is appearing before the Judiciary Committee, along with other guests like the Oversight Committee Chairman, Jim Comer, who came to ask questions. And it's really showing a bit of partisanship, Joe, I would say, on how exactly the special counsel's report related to President Biden is going down, depending on what side of the aisle.
I love that Jim Comer came in to a little a jazz improv session there with the chairman from the Oversight Committee. This is interesting. Robert Herr is playing defense today, and neither side seems to like what he's saying, because he doesn't seem to be fulfilling the roles that they were hoping he would today. Is that fair?
Well, on the one hand, Democrats don't like what he said in the report about the president and his poor memory, as Robert Herr described it. On the other hand, Republicans don't like that Robert Herr made the decision not to charge President Biden for willfully retaining documents when we've seen Donald Trump charged in his own case in Florida with many counts of willful retention of classified national security information. So that's what you're really seeing play out in the room today.
That's right. I think Republicans wanted him to talk about this Mr. Magoo that he met, though.
Sure.
And he's not doing that. Democrats don't want to completely blow away his credibility because he also decided not to charge Joe Biden.
Yes.
And sees these two cases, the Biden and Trump cases, as being very different.
Well, let's get another voice into this conversation. Joining us here in our studio in Washington is former Republican Congressman from Virginia, Denver Riggleman. Sir, always great to see you, especially to see you in studio
at
with
the
us
table.
On Bloomberg TV.
At the table.
And
at the
radio. Table. At the table, indeed. Of course, you're not in the room with everybody else today, but is anyone getting what they want out of this testimony? If it's, what's the point of it?
I think the point is to make sure that they get YouTube videos that they can actually show back in their districts.
Okay. So like any other hearing.
Yeah, it's shockingly partisan, right? So, you know, and so that's what my consultants would tell me to do, or my chief, right? Just like, okay, Denver, who cares what the world is saying? You're talking to your district right now. So what you're seeing, like when Comer comes in, it's the same thing. You know, it's click type of politics. It's click politics right now. And why? I mean, it's really hard to split hairs and then try to make the Democrats and Republicans happy. And, you know, somebody who actually read the Mueller report, I know that's nuts, but somebody who actually did it, I need to read the whole Herr report. But when you try to actually split the middle, or you want to create a narrative on somebody's age or memory, memory at that level and then not charge at the same time. I really don't know what they were trying to do. When it's the law, it's either illegal or not. Mm-hmm. Maybe just talk about intent, but it's not surprising to me that it's shockingly partisan today.
His line, "I needed to show my work, Denver." The question, of course, why would you go there? Why would you even characterize his memory or his physical ability? You're not a doctor. Did he make the case for why?
No, I don't think so. And I think that's the thing that surprised me a little bit. Almost, it would be like me, doing an investigation. I have this new AI company I have now, right? And it's like me doing an investigation. We get to that final point. I'm said, well, we would actually go after this person, but you know what? Actually, they meant to steal a Snickers bar, not a zero bar, from what we can see and what we talked about. But on the other hand, so since he stole the wrong thing and he's not really very good at things, we're just not going to charge him. It just doesn't make any sense to me. It's okay.
Did something wrong or you didn't.
Or you didn't. And that's the same thing with the Mueller report. Either you did something wrong or you didn't. And I think when they're trying to split the baby and it's this politicized right now, I think it's really a detriment to the American people, and I think it's actually a bit of an insult.
Well, of course, doing the business of the American people is what Congress was elected to do. They are literally representatives of each of their districts. So when we think about the business, they're doing hearings like this. They are potentially going to be voting on a TikTok bill tomorrow that would see it banned if ByteDance doesn't divest it. And then on the 22nd, they're going to try to fund the rest of the government, the hard parts of the government to fund, including Homeland Security, the Defense Department. Mm-hmm. Is their work working? Are you confident that they're going to be able to do those next six appropriations bills when they're also doing things like we're seeing today?
The short answer is no. I'm not very confident. And, for instance, when I know some of these representatives actually trying to, I would say, ferret through the TikTok technology or what it actually means to actually ban TikTok, or looking at other types of things. I don't know if they're behind the door actually talking about what other type of operations look with that type of technology. When you talk about information operations or radicalization, I don't even think they have the ability to digest it. I don't think they have the intelligence to do so. I think when you're looking at the other bills, it's become so partisan. And now what do we have, a one or two seat separation, maybe mm-hmm. 3-seat separation based on who shows up that day? Let me tell you, I think it's going to be a knockdown drag out, and I think you're going to see the screamers and the partisans really coming to play, and I think it's going to be literally insane for a lot of the sane to watch them.
I want you to tell us what happened with this TikTok thing, because 6 months ago, it was quiet. It was crickets. There was this massive effort to block the talk. We're going to ban it. There were four different bills, Democrats and Republicans acting like they liked each other. And then they hired lobbyists and dumped millions of dollars on the district, and the story went away. That in itself is a story, if you ask me. But how did it come back?
Well, it's election year. So, with election year, there's probably some polling going on or things like that, or they're getting constituent calls, but also you have lobbyists on both sides. I mean, you think about TikTok going away. How does that open up the market for other competitors? Number one.
Ask Donald Trump.
Yeah, ask Donald Trump.
That was
absolutely
the word yesterday.
This is about finances. This is about actually pay to play. This is rent seeking, right? So that's what you're actually looking. Gosh, I'm being very blunt here. I apologize.
That's why we asked.
But that's what's happening right now. The thing when you're talking about TikTok, I despise parts of TikTok based on the fact I was in information warfare.
Sure.
I sort of do that today, right, with the company that we have when you're talking about it. And I've told people that information war is the forever war. When you're looking at TikTok, there's other things I would rather do to look at TikTok for data purposes and information rather than totally ban it. I think, again, but that's nuance. Now you're talking about you actually have to have Republicans and Democrats talking to experts in the technical field on the nuance of the specific bill. Mm-hmm. And nuance is not part of this tribalism that's going on today. It's like, how many sticks can I bang together and run through the woods and scream, painted in bizarre earth paints? That's really what they're doing. And so that's what you're seeing right now is you're seeing a massive lobby flow coming in that's actually trying to dictate one way or the other where Democrats or Republicans are going to go in the TikTok situation.
Hmm. Well, and of course, they in the House will have a chance to vote on this measure tomorrow. That's the working plan. This goes to the floor on Wednesday. The Senate, though, seems much more in question. And some of what you're hearing from senators who seem more reluctant about this particular legislation are concerns around maybe the First Amendment on constitutionality. Also, the fact that this is a private company specifically being called out in a piece of legislation. Are those concerns warranted?
Well, the thing is, if you're banning TikTok, what does that do to Facebook? The senators, the Senate's showing some nuance right now. Mm-hmm. Now you're talking about, okay, what is the cutoff line when you're talking about radicalization and statistics, or you're talking about ownership of a said corporation, and what does that actually do for the future of any type of, I would say, any type of controls on this type of language? I mean, that, you know, for me being a First Amendment guy and also understanding that there's really bad things happening in the radicalization space, there has to be nuance where, again, you're not really representing the American people. You're representing special interests based on what your fundraising looks like mm-hmm. and based on what your polling and crosstabs looks like. And I get it. You want to win your race, but maybe do something and tell the truth to the American people. Or try to have some nuance in your thinking when you're going for
nuance. That is not a word that.
No, I don't. I don't even know if they know how to spell here. That. Yeah, you know, it's like NEWANCE or something. You know, that's how they spell it in Congress.
As we spend time with someone who knows, the former Congressman Denver Riggleman is with us here on Balance of Power. We're going to spend time later today with the president of Poland.
Okay.
On the later edition of Balance of Power, mm-hmm. he's meeting with Speaker Mike Johnson right now. The matter of Ukraine, mm-hmm. of course, is what they're talking about. What does Mike Johnson say to a foreign head of state like this, coming with an ask when there is absolutely no answer?
He's dancing on eggshells right now. And what he's trying to do is use a lot of big syllable words to say nothing. Hmm. That's what's happening behind closed doors right now. And, you know, I wonder, Mike Johnson has got to have, I don't want to say this in a really a come to Jesus on what's going on in Ukraine. And I think Poland can help him with that. There's got to be funding for Ukraine. Anybody who's outside of that box right now, I think, is in real trouble, because if we actually take away funding from Ukraine or that support, Poland's going to be very worried about Russia right now. Mm-hmm. So, again, I would love to be in that discussion right now. You know, my background is Eastern European Affairs. I deployed there, for Operation Allied Force on the Romanian-Serbian border. I know a little bit about Russia. Just a little, but I would love to be in there right now. But I can't imagine how that conversation is going with Mike Johnson having to appeal to the base of his party in the Freedom Caucus and talking, you know, to a representative from Poland at that level. It's got to be a mind-numbingly crazy conversation right now.
Well, and not just the members of his own conference, but former President Trump as well, who we know has opinions on Ukraine and whether or not the U.S. should continue to fund the war or just make sure the war comes to an end in whatever capacity. If you were in Poland, if you were a part of the Polish government, would you fear a second Trump administration? Should they?
Anybody sane should. Yeah. And I would say that the head of the Freedom Caucus is in Mar-a-Lago, by the way. So, I mean, that's really what we got. And I would say that the speaker actually go to Mar-a-Lago before he actually makes any decision going forward, because President Trump is the nominee for the presidential race in 2024 and could possibly win. So, yeah, I think what you're seeing right now, I would think that anybody who's sane in the Polish government is like, for the love of God, we hope that Trump doesn't win.
Pretty remarkable. He's meeting with the president a little bit later on.
4 p.m.
Before he makes his way here. Kaylee, I suspect that'll be a very different conversation. But he'll be able to tell the president about what he heard today.
Absolutely. And I think they're going to be very blunt in that conversation. And again, I can't believe as the United States of America, we have a GOP that's mostly against Ukraine funding. It seems like we're an upside down world right now.
Must be incredible coming back to Washington and walking freely as a former congressman.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Say whatever you want.
I would rather stick a pencil in my eye than be in Congress right now, so I'm happy.
Never one to
always
mince words.
Colorful.
Don't be a stranger. Great to see you, as
great
always.
Great to see you,
John. Denver Riggleman, the former congressman, former Air Force intelligence, founder of Rig Security, and author of The Breach, The Untold Story of the Investigation into January 6th. This is Bloomberg.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle-market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing. The passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
Thanks for being with us. Tuesday edition of Balance of Power here on Bloomberg TV and radio and on YouTube. You can always find the podcast if you showed up late. Go to Apple, Spotify, wherever you do that stuff and subscribe. As we focus on the economy, of course, something that is of dire concern to the Biden administration, with CPI Day bringing hotter than expected inflation. And Kaylee, this is the second time in a row we've seen a hotter than expected print, getting some folks to wonder, is this bad news for Joe Biden? Could we see a reacceleration of inflation? That would not be out of the question.
Or could we just see stalling progress in a deceleration of inflation? If this all proves sticky, does the price pressure relief that has been underway continue? Mm-hmm. And of course, this isn't just potentially a problem for political figures like the president of the United States, but non-political figures as well, like, say, the chairman of the Federal Reserve. Because, of course, Joe, the market is still anticipating that by midway through this year, the Fed could be cutting interest rates. The problem is, if inflation isn't doing what they want, is the Fed going to feel comfortable doing that?
These are big questions when you're trying to plan a campaign, never mind forecast the economy.
Absolutely. And if they're big questions that we pose to our guests, like the one joining us now. We're very lucky to say Danny Blanchflower, a tenured professor of economics at Dartmouth College, is with us. Professor, always great to have you on Bloomberg TV and radio. When you look at the data today, some of the more sticky components of inflation potentially that we're watching here, do you see signs that policy can or should ease in the not-so-distant future?
Well, there's nothing in the data today, I think, that changed my view from yesterday. And I always say to people, I mean, I was a person who sat and set interest rates. And I think very often the debate in public is not quite the debate that policymakers have. Because when you change interest rates, that impacts things in about 18 months' time. And you always should be thinking, what, you know, what's going to happen there? And has this latest piece of information changed my view of things? And I think the answer to that is no, we're running steady. But the problem, and you're rightly picking it up, is that the economy has been a puzzle. Inflation has remained stickier than you would have thought, given the rate rises. And consumer spending's remained stickier and held up more than you would have thought. There are, however, worrying signs. And I would be focused on the labor market and also looking at the rest of the world, because the UK and other European countries are clearly in recession. China's pretty slow. So the answer is, I don't think there's much would change my view. The big issue still is, have those rate rises that have been in place for a while now, have they fully had an effect? And the Fed, I guess, will be sitting, waiting and watching. I don't think it rules anything out. The market's a little up on the news, but I'm worried that something bad's still coming.
Danny Blanchflower, last time you joined us, we made clear that you would have failed me in your economics class, so I'm going to be careful here. But based on what you just said, if you're setting interest rates, it's all right. I can copy from Kaylee's paper in here. But if you're 18 months out on interest rates, that would indicate that we're not there yet, right? That there is more of an impact to come.
Well, I would have thought so. I mean, things, if you think of that logic, central bankers call it the forecast horizon thing. I mean, in a sense, that's what we have to think about. I would like to just focus back on some worrying signs. The question, in a sense, is always the two sets of worrying signs. Consumer confidence predicts recession. The other thing that tells you you're in recession, particularly, is in the labor market. And I think very worrying has been the big employment drops that you've seen on the household account in the last 4 or 5 months. Even bigger, the last 6 months, the declining in employment on that account is even bigger than it was in the last 6 months in 2007 as recession started. So maybe the dream world we're in, the positive environment we're in will continue. But there are worrying signs that, because that in a sense is the thing that picks up recession. So in a sense, the Fed must always think, well, okay, there are worrying signs here. To err on the side of actually cutting rates would probably be the right thing to do. I probably would, as always known as a dove, I would certainly be considering a rate cut. I certainly would rule out, as others have suggested, anything about a rate rise because the risks, I think, are to the downside. And the market's seeing...
Danny, we talked about the labor market where you see some concern with the acting labor secretary here in the U.S., Julie Hsu, just last night on Balance of Power. I asked her specifically about wages because she was touting the higher wages that people have received in part due to union contracts that have been negotiated over the last year and whether or not that could refuel inflation, lead to that kind of wage price spiral people often talk about. This was her response to that question.
We want to see real wage increases because more money in workers' pockets is a good thing. More money in the, you know, at the kitchen table, right, where families are making hard decisions about what they're going to buy and how to, you know, how to live a secure life. You're never going to hear me say that making sure that working people get what they deserve is a bad thing. I don't think that we have to choose between families paying prices that they can afford and getting wages that are going to allow them to feel some security. It's a false choice.
So she says it's a false choice, Danny. She also went on to tell us that what we're seeing in the labor market is the very definition of a soft landing, that there doesn't need to be a decision made between getting inflation under control and potentially breaking the labor market. To what extent is that actually true?
Well, I think you've started to see some real wage growth, and obviously that's a good thing. And I think the contrast to the wage price spiral we saw in the past was when there were union contracts that built in escalator clauses, automatic escalator clauses. Mm-hmm. With inflation, we haven't really seen any of that. We've seen a little bit emergence of worker power as economies have strengthened. And we've seen a little bit of a pickup in strike activity across the United States. But I don't think there's any evidence of a wage price spiral. And economies take a little time to move. The balance of power between labor and capital has swung over the last two decades so strongly in the favor of capital. It would be hard to tell people, aha, a slight movement back towards labor means that the central bank has to plunge in again and make workers worse off. Certainly not something in the sense that you'd expect the Biden administration to want to see. So I think it is really sitting pat holding with expectations that perhaps we will see worsening in labor markets, worsening in other things, and the central bank will have to cut rates. Not least because of what's going on in the world. Look at what's going on in China. China seems to have just come out of a deflation situation, but the rest of the world is looking at America as a fine place in the economy doing well. The last thing they want to do is make another error.
We're talking about today's CPI data and the economy with Danny Blanchflower. Lastly, Danny, gas prices, a big part of this CPI report. Is that the wild card that will tell whether Joe Biden has a good economy to tout by the end of this campaign?
Well, I mean, oil prices are a pretty tough one to forecast, given the stuff that's going on in the Persian Gulf and the problems that are there. The ability to control the global oil price is pretty, despite what Donald Trump and others say, the president of the United States doesn't actually control the global oil price. It's called a global price, and global shocks impact it. So I think we'll see. I think that's obviously, if there was to be a considerable spike in oil, that would be bad because it would impact their spending because they have to spend more at the pump. So yes, I think it's something that you really want to be mindful for. But again, once-off spikes of the oil price are not something that the central bank should respond to. It's once-off things. They'll spike today. They'll have an effect on inflation today, and in 12 months' time, they'll drop away. But, you know, these are complicated issues. The central bank has done pretty darn well. I didn't think the economy would be doing as well. And I've been more of a doom merchant than I probably should have been. But we'll see going forward. We can't assume everything's rosy with an election coming.
Well, that is the exact place I wanted to go with you, Danny, because sure, monetary policy definitely has an influence on the economy, but fiscal policy does as well. And actually, in the statement that President Biden put out addressing today's CPI report, saying there is more work to do to bring prices down, he said, look, I requested a lot of this in my budget. And as we heard in the State of the Union last week, the idea that he wants to see, tax breaks for people who own homes within certain income groups, child care, universal pre-K, these kinds of things that may not actually become reality, but he's at least asking for them coupled with higher taxes on the rich and on companies. I'm not sure if you've had a chance to look through the budget, but how should we be thinking about fiscal policy's influence on the economy now and going forward if some of these things actually do become a reality?
Well, I think the reality is that this whole series of economics papers, particularly from a famous economist called Ray Fair, who talked about how elections are won and how important the state of the economy is in determining whether the incumbent wins or not. So I don't think the Biden administration has missed that fact and understands that if people are feeling good on the economy, the incumbent gets the credit for it. And oftentimes you'll see even manipulation in the sense that the budget disproportionately spent in places that the president would like to win himself and for his party to win. So you'd expect to see that right now. And in some sense, the Congress says, well, look, I don't want to do that. I don't want to give the incumbent help. But that's really where we are. A booming economy is good for the incumbent. If the unemployment rate rises, inflation rate rises, then the narrative will be the president is to blame for it. But in a sense, he can say, well, look how good the economy is. Look how good it is compared to the rest of the world. This does look like a rosy scenario. Vote for me. And so this is crucial. This is crucial, not just the scale of the budget, but who it's spent on and where it's spent. And you'd expect it to be spent disproportionately if the president could have his way in places that are important for him to win.
We'll let you get back to fishing, Danny. It's great to see you, Danny Blanchfield.
That was, yes.
Back with us from Dartmouth College. I hope you're well. Let's keep tabs with Danny as we work our way through the cycle. This is kind of interesting as you've started this line of questioning now. Kaylee, mm-hmm. I feel like we check back every couple of months, see how he feels.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. as we should, especially as we progress into the summer months when potentially we're going to be having a more realistic conversation
true
about
enough.
Cutting back rates. And he seems to be a little bit more worried about what's happening in the labor market than we
yeah.
often hear here.
He went
Washington.
Back to it a couple times mm-hmm. without being asked, which is important. We'll find out about that lag effect when we get into the middle end of the summer, when it really does count, to Kaylee's point, going into the debates in the general.
Thanks for listening to the Balance of Power podcast. Make sure to subscribe if you haven't already at Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find us live every weekday from Washington, D.C. at noontime Eastern at Bloomberg.com.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV+.